For much of the past 2 years, award-winning journalist Earl Swift lived and reported on a tiny island in Virginia. The resulting book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island, is a portrait of this isolated community, a sweeping natural history of an extraordinary ecosystem, and a meditation on dire environmental realities that extend far beyond the shores of Tangier, which seems likely to succumb first among U.S. towns to the effects of climate change. Earl Swift is a Virginia-based journalist. He spent 2 years researching Chesapeake Requiem. He circumvented the Chesapeake Bay by sea kayak and has written for the Virginian Pilot. Again, his new book is Chesapeake Requiem, and we welcome Earl Swift to the roundtable this morning. Earl, thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thank you so much for having me.
So what brought you to this subject and wanting to spend this year with the watermen of the vanishing Tangier Island?
Well, I spent 21 years plus as a reporter for the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk, the big daily in Virginia, and was assigned to Tangier for a number of different stories over the years, and came to understand during those brief visits that this was a place that had relied on the Chesapeake for sustenance for more than two centuries, but was now in a terrible irony being erased by that very same water. And so I resolved in the spring of 2016 to go back and take up residence there to see what we'd lose if we lost this place, which is primed to be the first American town to have to be abandoned due to climate change.
So let's just talk about that first, is that you make the case that it seems very likely that this will be the first among U.S. towns to succumb to the effects of climate change. How is that the case?
Well, first of all, let's get our definition straight, because other islands in the Chesapeake, many of them inhabited, have disappeared over the last 150 years. So this isn't the first. It's the first that we recognize, I guess, as succumbing to what's going on with sea level rise now. We didn't recognize it until fairly recently. And what you see in the Chesapeake is that things were pretty stable there, as they were in most American waters, until the mid-19th century. And at that point, sea levels started to rise gradually. And throughout the 20th century, those rises accelerated in rate. And now in the early 21st, they're galloping along. And, you know, the numbers look insignificant at first glance. The average in the bay over the course of the 20th century was 1.7 millimeters a year, which is about a 16th of an inch. It seems like nothing. But with each rise, the effects of wind-driven waves on the shores of Tangier are more pronounced. The effects of tidal flooding is more pronounced. And it doesn't take many inches to start swamping the place when the highest ground on Tangier is 5 feet, and that's a solitary knob. Most of the island fails to clear 3. In fact, most of it is salt marsh that floods twice a day. So it's one of those insidious, sneak-up-on-you kind of situations that's been going on for a long, long time, and it's just now reached a kind of a critical point, a tipping point.
Give or take 470 people live on the island, and they're about 12 miles from the mainland, right?
From the nearest mainland port, yes.
Yes. So who lives there then?
Well, the folks that live there are descendants, almost to a one, of the original settlers who arrived in 1778 during the American Revolution. They're it's a uniformly white community, and they're descended from Cornish fishermen, and they have made their living culling the bay's justly famed blue crab and its once vast oyster population, and make their living the year round that way. It's close to a factory town for the production of seafood, and this little collection of people is kind of renowned as the soft shell crab capital of the world. If you enjoy soft shell crab, odds are a Tangierman put it on your plate.
Earl Swift is our guest. The name of the book is Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. So tell us about the Chesapeake Bay blue crab and the role they play in the story you tell, because it's a very large role.
It is. And the Chesapeake Bay blue crab, to look at it, I mean, it's a beautiful animal. It's about the size of a man's hand, and it gets its name from sapphire coloring on the legs of the animal. And it's a combative creature. It'll go for you. You know, its ferocity is outsized for something so small. And you catch it with a crab pot, which is an odd name for the contraption you actually use. It's more like a wire mesh cage. It sits on the bottom. Crabs crawl into it. They have a hard time finding their way back out. You haul the pot to the surface once a day and dump it into the bottom of your boat, and then you sort the crabs by sex and size and sell them to market. And this has been going on for generations on Tangier, regardless of weather. This is a hardy bunch of people. They'll go out in little boats and in big water, often on days when the deck is rocking so wildly under your boots that just remaining on your feet is an aerobic workout. And, you know, they have produced the crab that is the meat used in crab cakes imitated around the world. The Chesapeake Bay blue crab is the favorite at backyard crab boils and cookouts. And as a soft shell, which is really the way to eat it, legs and all, it's particularly delicious. It's pretty much unmatched in seafood, my opinion anyway.
So when we look at what's happening to Tangier Island, we also have to take into consideration what is happening with the population of the crab. You say the number of female crabs is dropping by roughly 7% in just 6 years. That is a stunning number.
Well, that was true during the 90s. There was a period from 1994 to 2000 when the number of sooks, which are adult female crabs, and therefore, you know, young bearing crabs, dropped by 70%. And there was real fear in the scientific community that extinction was at hand for the species. A combination of poor water quality, overfishing, a number of things that contributed to the situation. So the state of Virginia instituted a number of what crabbers saw at the time as draconian measures to try to help the crab, give the crab a leg up to recovery. And those included declaring huge pieces of the bay off limits to crabbing, you know, sanctuaries, and outlawing winter dredging, which was a practice among some crabbers back in the day. And they worked. They also instituted a freeze on new crabbing licenses, which many Tangiermen found particularly noxious because they felt that it discouraged young people on the island from pursuing the water. Although I think that if you honestly look at the trend lines, you'd see that kids had given up on crabbing long before those measures went into effect. So the crab has bounced back. This year they had a bumper crop. Last year was a good year. The year before that was good. So we've had three good years in a row, which by the Chesapeake standards is a run.
Mm. So it is not safe to say that many of the ingredients that are affecting the island and leaving it perhaps uninhabitable in less than 100 years is also having the same detrimental effect on the species of the blue crab.
What it would be safe to say is if the island disappears, it will have a profound effect on the blue crab, because the blue crab depends on protected water in which to take shelter, especially when it molts and when it mates. And the bottom of the bay is covered with pastures, basically, of seagrass. And it's in that seagrass that the blue crab does its business. And you take the island away, and you'll take away the lee in which that seagrass thrives. The island basically serves as a breakwater for the blue crab. You know, on the one hand, you'll be minus a lot of crabbers, so you could argue that the crab will thrive if the island disappeared. But the fact is that its habitat will be destroyed.
Tell us the story, as you do in the book. Tell us a little bit about Asbury Pruitt and his significant role in this story.
Okay, well, let me explain a little bit about Tangier. This is a wafer of mud and marsh that barely clears the tides, you know, highest point 5 feet, most of it 3 feet. And it's about a mile wide by 3 miles long, smack in the widest part of the bay. And because it has so much open water to its west, a lot of what mariners call fetch, which is room to build waves, for decades, for generations, it's been pounded from its west side by waves. This is not a sandy island where the surf just rolls up the beach. It's just a plug of peaty soil, dark peaty soil in which marsh grass is rooted. So when waves come in, they tear off huge chunks of the marsh and carry it off, and it never comes back. In other words, the island is not migrating like the barrier islands. It's just disappearing. So Tangiermen were vaguely aware that their island was getting smaller in the 19th century and in the early 20th, but it wasn't until this fellow Asbury Pruitt, who worked for the Navy on the island, he was island-born, but a contract worker for the Navy, noticed from his workplace that he could actually see pieces of it, you know, falling away. And so he took an iron pipe and he jammed it in the marsh, and then he measured the distance from that iron pipe to the surf zone on the west side of the island. And it's the first time in 1964 that anybody had actually tried to quantify exactly how much Tangier was losing. And what he found shocked everybody. I think that first year the island lost 12 feet of shoreline. You know, it became 12 feet narrower. So in the course of in the time it took a crabber to go from diapers to captaining his own boat, his island was 300 or more feet narrower than it had been. And Asbury's measurements also showed that through the 60s and 70s, those numbers started to accelerate. By the late 1980s, Tangier was losing upwards of 30 feet per year to wave action. Now, Tangiermen will tell you, well, you know, what's happening here is not sea level rise, it's merely erosion, because they separate the two phenomena when, in fact, they are interlinked. The reason that erosion became more effective, more destructive, was because the seas were, in fact, coming up. And you could see that around the island if you knew what to look for.
So what do you believe can be done? What do you think the steps are and should be taken to prevent, perhaps, the inevitable of losing the island?
Well, there is a fix. I would hesitate to call it a plan or a proposal, but the Army Corps of Engineers has a concept on the table, which would call for putting a riprap seawall completely around the island's perimeter and blowing in dredge fill from the dredging of navigation channels down bay to raise up the level of its ground. And, you know, that would buy it a lot of time. That would be a lasting solution. But it would also cost into the hundreds of millions of dollars, which would be a tough sell when we're talking about a community of 460, 470 people. The Corps has approached it not as a plan to save Tangier for its human inhabitants, but as a plan to preserve habitat for migratory waterfowl and other animal life. And strange as it might seem, it has a much better chance of getting funding going that route than it would have if it pursued saving the town itself.
You do point out this is Trump country. Most of the residents on Tangier were supporters of Donald Trump.
Big time, 88% of them. Yeah, they're and remain very enthusiastic Trump supporters.
Given the president's thoughts on climate change and the environment, what were they voting for? What were they hoping for?
They were hoping for a guy who could cut through government red tape and get them help instead of studies. You know, the Corps of Engineers for years has looked at Tangier's situation and has performed one study after another trying to come up with a solution. And Tangiermen feel studied out. And so they figured Trump, with his history as a builder and managing big projects, was a guy who might be able to actually get things moving. And they shared also his views on climate change, because Tangiermen, this is a deeply religious place. It's really almost a working theocracy of old school Christians. And they are biblical literalists, most of them. And, you know, it's hard to sell the notion of climate change to someone who firmly believes that man is too puny and insignificant to materially affect the works of God. And, you know, there's another diabolical problem that Tangier faces, and that is that in addition to having the sea level come up, the island itself is sinking. It's subsiding. The crust of the earth under it is subsiding into the mantle. And it's doing it at about the rate that the seas were coming up through the 20th century. So it's really twice as bad a problem as it initially appears to be. And in fact, relative sea level rise in the lower bay is about the highest on Earth. It's very hard, though, to convince Tangiermen that their island is sinking when scientists will tell you that subsidence is a byproduct of the last ice age, which ended 11,000 years ago, and Tangiermen believe the Earth to be only 6,000 years old. So you've got some philosophical differences between the scientific community and little Tangier, and the Tangiermen are pretty intransigent on it.
What has the reaction been among those residents to the book?
It's been very interesting, Joe. The Tangiermen have been not only studied by the government, they've been examined by the media for more than 100 years. There's been a steady stream of reporters coming to Tangier to write about this strange place that seems lost in time. That's a phrase you see in a lot of their stories. A place so isolated that it has its own style of speech, its own dialect, which is true, it does. And so I think that they were grateful. Well, they told me they were grateful that here came a reporter in me who stuck around long enough to get the story right and not write the same story that's been written dozens and dozens of times before about the place. If you come in for a day or two, you're going to wind up with the same story that the reporter before you wrote. It's almost guaranteed. And so staying for 14 months was really able to become a member of the community and to take part in the island's daily rhythms. And it's a wonderful place. I really came to love it and wouldn't miss it if it disappeared.
The name of the new book is Chesapeake Requiem by Earl Swift. The subtitle, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. What do you miss in just 2 days of taking away a story from there? What are you missing? Is it just obviously the more in-depth and less of the novelty of the place?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a place where everyone gets around by golf cart. The roads are the size of sidewalks. And so most of your interactions on the island, there is no cell phone service. Everybody has a landline. And really, island life is dictated by face-to-face encounters. So if you wander down the main ridge, I was on bicycle for my 14 months there. And in the course of riding my bike, through the town, I would run into a couple of dozen people and stop and have conversations with a good many of them. And it's that slow accumulation of experience and just dealing with people one-on-one that you miss, I think, if you parachute in as a reporter and get out after 2 days. And you also, most of the time, don't go to church. And going to church on Tangier is different from what it is on the mainland. It has a really pragmatic purpose. This is an island whose people have very little control over natural forces that dictate the quality of their lives. And so they early on turn to prayer. And you don't get that if you don't go to church. You don't see it in action. So whenever I'm contacted by reporters who ask, what should I see and do? Who should I talk to? The first thing I tell them is you got to go on a Saturday and stay over for Sunday, and you got to go to every church service you can.
What about the government, the leadership, the structure, the town structure?
Oh, it's an incorporated town in Accomack County, Virginia, which is on the Eastern Shore. Has a mayor, has an elected mayor, and an elected town council and a town manager. The town council has five people on it, and it's an informal style of government. I will tell you that. I've just painted a picture that makes it sound like it's straight out of a civics textbook, but it's a very informal structure. And again, most decisions are the result of consensus achieved in face-to-face contact. So this is a place that very much depends on talking to people and just talking to each other, and a place where women hold great sway in really fashioning the island's opinion on any given subject, because the men are off in their boats alone, many of them, for most of the day, for 8 to 12 hours a day. And women run the town. in their absence. And if there is a controversy that needs addressing, it's been addressed long before the men bring their boats back to port. So it's a mix of formal government and informal but very effective female-led kind of opinion shaping.
Well, the book is fascinating. May I also say, and I know I don't usually mention this, but it is a beautiful object. Your publisher did you very well, sir. It's a beautifully bound and put together book as an object.
Yeah, they did do a nice job. I've never seen anything quite like it.
No, it's really beautiful. It's called Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. It is published by Day Street. Earl Swift, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Well, Joe, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.